Great to be here. It's good to see you. Many, many months ago, when Pastor Eric and Pastor Matt kind of sent an email to me about, hey, would you be interested in doing this on this particular weekend? I knew that that was our 40th wedding anniversary weekend. And I said to my wife, would you like to go to Jackson Hole for our 40th wedding anniversary? She said, sure. Said, well, I've got to agree to do a conference there, but and she says, no, that's good. That works out well. So here we are. I wanted to meet people who actually live in vacation land, okay, and just see what it was like to live here. And it's not vacation to you. You guys probably go somewhere else to take a vacation. You probably come to where we're at in Southern California. I don't know. But it's a pleasure to be here. Oftentimes I get the question, 40 years, that's becoming more and more rare. Just heard one of the young ladies talk about the fact that her parents just celebrated their 50 years. That's becoming more and more rare in our culture today. My grandparents celebrated 75 years married. Of course, she was married when she was 13 and he was 15. All right? Yeah, and it lasted 75 years. So, even got a personal letter from Ronald Reagan, who was president at that particular time. And so, how do you make it that long? Well, our wedding began with two funerals. I had to die, and she had to die to self. Every good Christian wedding begins with two funerals. That has to happen. If it doesn't, you'll pay the consequences down the line. If it's not a Christian wedding, then it is a temporary truce. That's what marriage becomes. And now you're just, it's just a temporary ceasefire and see how long you can make it. There are secular marriages that make it a long time, but it's not the type of marriage that God ever intended from the very beginning. So we want to get into this, and we want to talk about it. Tonight, we're going to talk about two things. One is God's design for marriage, because that's going to set the foundation for everything we want to talk about in the rest of our conference. And then we're going to talk to the role of the husband tonight. And this is where the women take copious notes. They just take detailed notes on this one. Tomorrow morning, then, we'll deal with the role of the wife. That's where the husbands usually take lots of notes. And then we're going to talk about communication. And then we're going to talk about the physical relationship in marriage as the final thing to top it all off. So that'll give you just a little bit of an idea of what we're going to be doing this weekend. And you should have notes in front of you. I think if you don't have notes, they'll make sure. Who needs notes? And let me encourage you to take notes, whether or not you will need them, or you're going to run into somebody who will, then you'll have notes to be able to help them. Universally, I found that to be true. I've had an opportunity to counsel many, many, probably into the hundreds now, of married couples who are having serious problems. And when God begins to really work in that particular marriage and really change them, then all of a sudden people around them and their friends and family members begin to see the changes, and they usually come to them and say, what in the world is going on? Tell us how you're doing this. What's really happening? And then they all of a sudden become counselors of other couples. I've seen that happen over and over and over again. But other people had to see the transformation in their life first before that happens. So let's talk a little bit about God's design for marriage. The culture that we live in is, there's one thing that you can say for sure, that the marriage is in trouble. And you can ask the question, why is that the case? Why is marriage in trouble? I mean, it's rare to find someone in some family who doesn't have some relative, whether it's close relative or distant relatives, that's going through a divorce or something else has happened. in that particular marriage, and you have friends also, those kind of experiences are going on. That's where, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, that was a rarity. Now it's common. It's very, very common. And it seems to be something that's increasing, whether you believe the statistics or not, about the 50% statistic that now anybody that's married, there's good reason to question that a little bit because the way in which they came up with those statistics. But nevertheless, everybody recognizes the fact that the failure of marriage is happening everywhere in our culture today. Everybody recognizes that. And the question is, why? Why is that going on? Well, one answer to that is the fact that people marry for the wrong reason. That's certainly a big issue. People marry for the wrong reason. That contributes to the fact that marriages are having problems. Now, I'm going to give you a list of reasons why people get married, and this is not an exhaustive list, it's just to be representative, but it'll give you a little bit of an idea. Some people get married because they've been promiscuous prior to marriage, and as a result of that, they have this overwhelming guilty conscience about the fact that now they ought to get married, and so they feel that they're forced to get married, which in reality, the Bible indicates that they're not ready for marriage. They're not ready for the discipline of marriage at that particular point. Just because they've been promiscuous, and just because they get married and have a little piece of paper that says that they're married, that's something, it's a little contract from the church that says that kind of thing, or from the, not the church, but a little contract that actually comes from the state government that tells them that they're married now. Somehow all of a sudden they have the discipline to maintain that marriage. Usually not. That's usually not the case. That's more of a Roman Catholic view of marriage than a biblical view of marriage. Roman Catholics, once a couple's been promiscuous, try to get them married as quickly as possible. Now, I realize a lot has changed since Vatican II, and I'm familiar with the changes in Vatican II, but that still seems to be the case in a lot of Roman Catholic marriages today. So, some people get married because they've had a physical relationship prior to marriage. They feel guilty over that. In order to quell their guilt before God, let's get married. There may be a pregnancy involved. There may not be a pregnancy involved. Whatever the case may be, they get married. Then other people, they get married to compensate for faults. To really run from faults. Or run from what they perceive certain faults are. Some people run from poverty. And so they want to marry somebody who has money. Maybe you know somebody who's done that before. The old saying is still true. If you marry for money, you end up earning every penny of it. All right? That's true. You marry for money, you end up earning every penny of it. Other people marry because they want somebody different than them. They're very, very quiet, unassuming. And the person that they marry is really outgoing, gregarious, life of the party, exciting to be around. That's the kind of person I want to live with. And so they get married to that particular person, so the rest of their life will be a party. And exciting all the time. The other person marries them because they see them as quiet and stable and so thoughtful. Now you got to notice this. Our strengths prior to marriage become our greatest weaknesses after marriage. Our strengths prior to marriage become our greatest weaknesses after marriage. Why is that so? Because 5 years into the marriage, then the person who's really quiet is looking at their spouse and saying, is he ever going to stay home and spend one night? He's all over the place. They were going to settle down. And he's thinking to himself, is she ever going to do anything but sit there and read books the rest of her life? Is that all she's going to do? She'd rather read about life than experience life? The strengths prior to marriage become the greatest weaknesses after marriage. Now you notice, the individual husband and wife, the male and female, has not changed going into marriage. They're not changed. But our perception of them has changed. That's the key. Our perception of them, they're still the same person. The one person is very gregarious, very outreaching, life of the party. The other person's quiet, unassuming. They're still the same person. But our perception of who they are now has changed. As a result of that, then we then become discouraged about that. Maybe I'm in the wrong marriage. Running from faults. And we could spend the next 2 weeks talking about just that area of the way in which people run from faults that they perceive. Faults that maybe are part of their background or their family or whatever the case may be, personality-wise. Then some people get married in order to realize an image. After doing almost 45 years of marriage counseling, these are things that come straight out of marriage counseling. And gentlemen, I got to tell you something. The women are way out in front of us on this one. By the age of 6, they have their weddings planned out. They do. And, you know, for a lot of guys, you ask them if they're going to get married prior to the 18, they say, well, maybe someday in the future, I don't know. But these gals have their wedding planned out. I remember I proposed to my wife 40 years ago. 40 years ago. She hasn't changed a bit. So I proposed to her then, and I asked her, what do you think about our wedding? What should we do? And she says, I don't know. I don't know about that. Well, 15 minutes later, she was sitting in her house describing to her sister everybody was going to be in the wedding, all the dresses and what they're going to look like and what the tuxedos are going to look like. I'm going, what? You haven't thought about this? She knew this in detail. So some people realize an image. They get married to do that. They kind of picture themselves in a cute little house with a white picket fence around it, and the children are playing happily in the yard. And that's the way, and that's what they marry to get, is that kind of image fulfilled in their life. So they get married for that reason. And then there are other people that look at it and say marriage really is a way to legitimize sex. Oftentimes the guys are way out in front of the gals on this one. All right, I don't have to feel guilty anymore about sex because God says it's okay in marriage. That's all right. So, in reality, it's really not marriage that's in trouble. It's the people that are in marriage that's in trouble, you see? Marriage is not the problem. It's the people who are in the marriage that is the problem. Marriage itself is doing really well. Marriage itself is exactly the way in which it was originally designed to be. Even though man's desperately trying to change that now. And you can see that from a cultural standpoint. So people get married for the wrong reason. That gives you a little bit of an idea of why there's so many problems that are going on. But you add to that the fact that the family and the concept of marriage is under attack almost anywhere you go in culture and society today. Anywhere you go. The whole Playboy philosophy is an attack upon God's institution of marriage. Why is that? Because it treats other people as sex objects. That whole Playboy philosophy. It treats other people as there to satisfy me. That's an attack upon God's institution of marriage. And the more we develop this particular weekend, the more you're going to be able to see this. You can see this in gay and lesbian agendas as well. That's attack upon God's institution of marriage. You can see it in entertainment mediums, TV sitcoms, the internet, movies, radio, almost anywhere you see marriage pictured. It is a distorted view of what God intended marriage to be. There's a new television sitcom that's on called The Modern Family. That's a whole twisted view of what God intended the marriage to be. Materialism. The whole focus on elevating things above people. I need to have a house. I need to have a boat. I need to have two or three cars. I need to have a cabin. I need to, you just add anything you want to that, and people are elevating things above people. I saw that when I was a pastor several years ago in Ohio. We planted a church right in the suburban area, and what grew up around it was just beautiful homes. Some of them had maids, butlers. They're a part of these homes, and even though those homes were beautiful, the marriages inside those homes were falling apart. I cannot tell you how many times I counseled children coming out of those very wealthy homes and how they would, in tears, express to me the fact, I wish we lived in a shack if just we could get mom and dad to live together and love one another. Don't care. Materialism is attack upon God's institution of marriage, where now we elevate things above people. That's much more important to people in our society today than anything. And then we have substitutes for marriage, all kinds of substitutes for marriage. We have trial marriages. That's being proposed in several states now here in the United States. That is, there is no such thing as a real marriage. We'll have a trial marriage. So I sign up with another person, whoever they may be, to have a trial marriage. We're not fully and completely married yet because not all the legal things are set so that we can file our income tax together. But it's just a trial marriage to see how it goes. And then it ends at a specific time. And then we can decide whether or not after that time, whether or not we really want to get really married. There are proposals in state legislatures now to enact trial marriages. Then you've got contract marriages, which, okay, I'm willing to get married to you, but it's for a certain period of time, like you would sign a contract on a piece of real estate. All right? You would rent a facility for a certain period of time, and at the end of that particular time, that contract would automatically come to an end. The marriage would be automatically dissolved unless the couple decided to re-up the contract. So there would be no divorce. You just decide ahead of time on the end date of the marriage. All right, we want a marriage for 10 years, just for sake of argument. So for 10 years, we're going to have a marriage. We may produce some children in that marriage. But at the end of that 10 years, automatically and legally, that marriage comes to an abrupt end unless we decide to renew that contract. And both parties have to mutually agree to renew the contract. And if one party decides not to renew the contract, then the marriage is automatically null and void. And contract marriages. Live-in lovers, that's a big deal. People that are semi-married, which is a kind of close to being trial marriage, only it has more legal standing than a trial marriage would. And the full legal, you're kind of semi-married for about a year, 6 months, whatever the case may be, and the full legal contract doesn't take up go into full contract of a marriage until that 6 months is up or a year is up. So people become semi-married. And then you've got prenuptial agreements, which is basically an agreement to end a marriage before you even begin the marriage. And then you got lap marriages. Those are really big around, especially the San Francisco area. You got, she owns a house and a place on one side of the bay, and he owns another house and a place on the other side of the bay, and they get together and sleep in each other's bed once in a while. On paper, they're married, but they live separately. And they live independent lives, work independent jobs, may have children, may not have children, share the children back and forth in their two different homes. So, living apart together. Wow. So now you begin to realize, oh, what's going on in our culture today? The culture itself, the family, what we consider to be the traditional family is under a tremendous amount of pressure. Then you've got transgenderism. I know they don't like that term, so we'll call it transgenders. Because it makes it sound like a disease and they hate that term, but transgenders. Which complicates things even further. Am I a guy or a girl or whatever the case may be? What is my identity? I'm doing a whole presentation at Grace Community Church here in a couple of weeks on that very issue. On transgender and the whole self, defining self culture. How do we define ourselves? And why is that so important in our culture today? And my own self-definitions. Why is that so significant? So, the family's under attack. So what is the effect? What is the effect of the whole thing? Well, there's twofold effect. One is the fact that many young people are unsure about marriage. They're thinking about getting married, but they're kind of unsure. They see all the changes that are going on in culture and society. They hear their friends talk. They hear about their friends and their parents' marriages. They find out the difficulty of those particular marriages. And they wonder, are we going to be a casualty in the same way? Is that the way it's going to happen in our marriage? Are we going to end up in a disaster? That's a good question. The second effect is that a lot of people are already married, have lost hope. A lot of people who are already married have lost hope. They think there really is no hope. It's either divorce or death. One of us is going to die, and then finally they'll put the other person out of their misery. All right? And of course, for Christians, murder is not an option. So, what is it? What are we going to do? I know some of you may think murder is an option. It's not. How are we going to handle that? So, a lot of people unsure. I work in a university setting. I can see this. And I think we get, at Master's University, the cream of the crop of Christian young people all around the world. It's just phenomenal. I've worked in three university settings now up to this particular time, and by far my favorite setting, and I don't just say it because I work there now, is Masters. Because I think we get just the best of the best. They're just phenomenal. But when they come into our offices, in the counseling office, and they say, hey, we're planning on getting married. Are you interested? I mean, can we get some premarital counseling? I mean, you can see the far-off look in their eye about the fact that we just don't want to be one of those divorce statistics. We want to make sure this is the right thing. You can see it. And so they're very, very unsure. I think that's a big key to the reason why a lot of young people today are waiting longer and longer to get married. I mean, my grandmother was married at 13. All right? My grandfather would have been locked in jail nowadays. But they had a very successful marriage. And almost 200 years ago, you would never had a choice as to who your spouse was going to be. Even in European cultures, parents arranged marriages. Arranged marriages. You didn't have a choice. You'd maybe have a little bit of a say, what you liked or didn't like, but if your parents arranged it and set it up, you had to follow through, so two people had to get this, and boy, people today will hate this. They had to learn to love each other? Is that even possible? And sometimes when marriage gets into trouble and they finally come into counseling and they say, we're in trouble, we don't know what to do, we've tried everything, now we finally come to you, so I'm the last resort. No pressure. Yeah. I'll say to them, okay, listen, the Bible says this. You can love each other as a husband and wife should love each other. And right now, if you can't do this, then the Bible says, we'll drop down a little bit lower. You can learn to love each other as friends. And if that doesn't work right now, then we're going to drop down a little bit lower. Then we're going to start on this level. You can learn to love each other as enemies, the Bible says. So we're going to start on one of those levels. We're going to start on learning to love each other as enemies and then move up to friends and then from friends to the way in which husband and wife should genuinely love one another. We're going to start on one of those levels. That's where we're going to start moving forward. Okay. Well, this is why I love doing what I'm doing. I love being a pastor. One of the luckiest guys, listen, there's no such thing as luck in a God-created world. One of the most providence guys in the room here is Matthew. He's a pastor. Why? Because he has the opportunity to proclaim lasting answers. And by the way, you do too. That's why I love what I do. We've got to get busy proclaiming them. There are numerous examples I could give you over the years that if you would have seen this couple when they first came for biblical counseling for help from Scripture, their marriage, you would have said, oh my goodness, that marriage is absolutely hopeless. Those people ought to give up. And to see God radically turn that marriage around. That can happen. And that can happen to you. So, let's talk about this a little bit. What are those lasting answers? The first one is we have to take a look at the contemporary presuppositions in God's designs. When we're talking about presuppositions, we're talking about the way in which people assume or presume that marriage began. Where did marriage come from? You ever see the film several years ago, The Gods Must Be Crazy? And in that film, there's a little clip. It was a famous film for a short amount of time, but there's a little clip of an African bushman who finds a Coke bottle for the first time. Never, ever seen a Coke bottle before. And he picks up the Coke bottle and examines the Coke bottle, doesn't know what to do with it, tries it like a hammer. Didn't know how to do it, and tries to hang it on his ear, and you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff he tries to do with that Coke bottle. He had never ever seen a Coke bottle before. Well, if you don't know what something is, then you don't know how it functions, and if you don't know how it functions, you don't know really what to do with it. And marriage is a lot like that today. A lot of people assume they know what it is. But they really don't know what it is. And because they don't know what it is, they don't know how to function in marriage. Nobody's ever really gotten down nuts and bolts and said, this is the way that God designed marriage. This is the way it should function, into details with them. And we're going to do that. We're going to do that this weekend. And the first thing you begin to realize is that out in our culture and society today, there are a lot of secular theories about marriage. Here I live in an environment which much larger secular universities around us. We've got California State University system close to us. We have UCLA. And many of those universities have graduate programs, and in their graduate programs, they have sociology classes and psychology classes. And one of the required courses, or sometimes there's a series of courses that have to be taken, is marriage and family courses. We just had a woman go through our program who, her and her husband, back about 5 years ago, got saved, got involved in a church. She teaches psychology at UCLA Med School to future medical doctors. And she has a PhD, and she has two master's degrees. She's three upper division degrees. And she and her husband were about ready to get a divorce. And their pastor sat down with them and began to work them through problems. And eventually she said, where did you learn how to do this? And he said, well, I went through the graduate program at the Master's University. Well, do you suppose they let me go through that program? And so she just recently went through the program and graduated. But she sent me a letter, and sometimes I read this letter in my marriage and the family class, about the fact that I went through upper division courses on marriage and family at two different major universities, and I got more out of your one class in marriage and the family than I did in those two full degrees. Because I was starting from a biblical presupposition. They're starting from a very secular presupposition. And those secular theories, if you were to come to my office, you could see a lot of the books. I have a lot of those secular theories, graduate level books, where they teach these theories. Basically, marriage, they say, is a result of man's planning and design. If you have a chance to look up United Nations View of the Family on the internet, you can pull it up and begin to read it, and it will shock you, because what they talk about in terms of a family and what we talk about from a Christian perspective in terms of the family are 180 degrees the opposite things. Two hobos living in a boxcar for any extended amount of time is considered a family to them. All right? That's a family. Anybody living together in any kind of environment, that's a family. So what you get really is some evolutionary caveman type of arrangement, where back in prehistoric times, cavemen invented the idea of marriage. There were two cavemen. One was Mog and the other one was Bog. And one day, Mog said to Bog, "Ooh, can't tell your woman from my woman." "Ooh." Bog said, "Ooh, you right. Can't tell your woman from my woman. Ooh, what we do?" Mog says, "Ooh, I have idea. You take woman to nearby cave, and all of her children will follow her." "Ooh." Bog says, "Ooh, sounds good to me." So he grabs a woman by hair and drags woman to nearby cave, and all of her children follow her. And on the way, Bog turns around and says to Mog, "Ooh, what we call this?" Mog says, "Ooh, not sure. Ooh, let's call it marriage." "Ooh," Bog says, "sounds good to me. Call it marriage. Ooh." And now we have marriage. Now, you may think that I'm crazy by using that illustration. But if you were to take all the sophisticated theories and the development of those particular theories and boil them down to their least common denominator and explain it, that's exactly what's going on in secular culture and society today. That's exactly what's going on in upper division, graduate level, and PhD level courses on sociology, that the idea is that man invented marriage because in a hunter-gatherer type of society, or even in an agricultural type of society, a marriage arrangement was needed in order to have clear definitions of roles and what people should do. But now in our more sophisticated societies today, we really don't need that anymore. That's not needed. In fact, rather than calling someone adulterous, maybe there's a person who, they're going to say, has just multiple variations of interest. Why should we put them into some kind of horrible category and call them adulterous? Or an adulterer? Wow, that appeals to the sinful nature, doesn't it? Not wrong anymore. I'm just a person who has multiple interests. So we get polygamy. That's possible. Polandry. Polygamy is one man with several wives. Polandry is one woman with several husbands. So we get those as possible options. And by the way, In some states now, that is being proposed as options now. So, you understand that if you believe that man invented marriage, then he can destroy marriage anytime he wants or redefine marriage any way he wants because he invented it. The way that you see the origin of marriage definitively affects the way in which you look at marriage today. If you believe that man invented marriage, he developed the idea. He conceived of the concept. So he can, if he wants, especially now that he's much more sophisticated than the prehistoric caveman, he can redefine it any way he wishes. And that is exactly what's going on in laws today. You may think that I'm crazy, but we're not very far off. I mean, homosexual marriages, it's just assumed that that's just going to be, it's going to happen every state, every country around the world. That's just an assumption anymore. But now what's really coming down the line is the capacity for any human being to marry animals they want. You want to marry your sheep, you want to marry your horse, you want to marry your dog, you want to marry your cat. And there are actually lawyers being trained in the profession now of representing animals in divorce court. I talk about this in our graduate classes, and one of my students thought I was nuts, and she ended up going back to Atlanta, and she sent me the front page of the Atlanta Constitution. Said, Dr. Stree, I thought you were crazy when you were talking about there, but here she sent me a whole article on all these lawyers being trained to represent the rights of animals in divorce. All of this is happening. But that's the most profound thing is not even that. By the year, probably 2025, and I won't have to deal with this. Pastor Matt, you are going to have to deal with it. I'll be dead and in the grave in heaven and be happy. But you're going to have to deal with this in society, and that is people marrying robots. Because they're increasingly creating robots to be so lifelike to the human touch, in terms of response. Imagine marrying somebody that's not going to get old, not going to get sick, not going to get fat. Imagine marrying somebody who will not argue with you, but something that will have sex with you anytime you wish to have sex and be happy all the time. And never have to take psychotropic drugs or anything like that. Imagine that. That's around the corner. That's not far. And they're even advocating this in terms of pedophilia too, creating lifelike, childlike robots so that in order to decrease pedophilia in the culture and society, that's the way they're going to sell it to everybody. Actually, I think the opposite is going to happen. Once that happens, then, and it will happen, once that does happen, it will actually increase pedophilia in culture. Once you feed that animal, that monster, it'll just grow. Childlike robots whom you can marry. So, if man invented marriage, he can define it any way he wants. Your kids are going to have to deal with this. And it's not far. It's right around the corner. Because I see articles increasingly almost on a week-to-week basis on specific companies around the world that are developing lifelike robots that we can marry, and we never are not going to have any problems anymore. But I'll tell you what, man did not invent marriage. God did. Let me show you why this is so revolutionary in the culture in which we live and face today. What does the Bible say about this? Marriage was given by God. I want you to take your Bible. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. Verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Now I want you to look at this verse very carefully, because there's something dynamic that's going on here. When he says, let us, this is not talking about the angels, because the angels are not a part of the creative process. They're only observing the creative process. This is probably, most theologians believe, the first reference to the triunity of God in all the Bible. Let us make man. Let us, plural, make man singular in our, plural, image singular, after our, plural, likeness singular. You don't quite see this as well in the English, but you can pick it up. In the Hebrew, it's very, very clear. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Now, what's really key here is that if you take a look at image and likeness, I read it, THM thesis, where a guy went into in-depth research on image and likeness, and both of those terms go back to Chaldean roots in the Hebrew language. So go back to Chaldean roots, which actually means obelisks. Obelisks. Back in ancient times, when a king would go into a territory and conquer a territory. Testing, testing, testing. We're good? Oh, we're back. Okay. So you may not know what I said earlier, but we'll pick it up later. All right. So sex and procreation is a part of marriage. Gender distinctiveness is called very good. God created Adam fully and completely male, and that was very good. He created Eve fully and completely female, and that was very good. All of that was very, very good from the very beginning. It was not a bad thing. So marriage is not to compete with human options or substitutes, trial marriages, contract marriage, semi-marriage, lap marriages, whatever the case may be. It's not to compete with those kind of things. Marriage was never intended to be that way. You'll see why I say that. Marriage really is a picture of Christ's relationship to his bride, the church. It teaches an important spiritual reality about God's relationship to his people. God was setting up marriage as a picture for us to understand our relationship to him, much the same way in which God viewed himself as the husband of Israel. Christ is the groom of his bride, the church. We understand the implications of that far better when we understand human marriage and the way human marriage interacts. They are two, yet they are one. They are two, yet they are one. So is the mystery of Christ's relationship to the church that Pastor Matthew just read about there in Ephesians 5. So you begin to see that all of this is critical in understanding marriage. So what is marriage supposed to be? Let's grab your Bible again. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. Look at this real carefully. Then the Lord God said, it was not good that man be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. It was not good for man to be alone. God did not create marriage for the purpose of having babies. Not the reason why God created marriage. That's a Roman Catholic view of marriage. In fact, that view, a Roman Catholic view of marriage, goes back to the Middle Ages when hundreds of thousands of Christian men were dying in the Crusades against Muslims, trying to reclaim Jerusalem and the Promised Land for Christianity. Hundreds of thousands, and the Pope realized that so many people were dying at that particular time, and so the Pope and the Cardinals got together and by edict declared that the purpose of marriage was for procreation. That's the reason why from that particular point on, later on, then you have so many Roman Catholic families having such large families. Some 12, 15, 20 children. Many of them, by the way, most of the children would die before the age of 6 by some kind of disease or health issue. But Nevertheless, they would have so many children in order to replenish the ranks of the Roman Catholic Church, and that spread throughout the world during that particular time. But God never intended marriage's purpose to be procreation. It was the blessing of marriage. I mean, back in chapter 1, in verse 28, it says, "And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." You see that? But in chapter 2 and verse 18, it's God didn't recognize the fact that Adam had no kids. It's not what he says. Adam recognized the fact that Adam was alone. That's the critical thing. That helps me to understand what the purpose of marriage is. The original purpose of marriage then was built upon the fact that man was alone, and it was not good that man was alone. Companionship now becomes the biblical purpose of marriage. And when a marriage gets into trouble, that's one of the first things that suffers, is companionship. Companionship now becomes the focus and purpose of marriage. Being companions. One of the things my wife and I really enjoy is just spending time with one another. Companionship. That's the reason why you have a couple that have been married so many years and one of them dies. It's so heartbreaking for the surviving spouse because they feel so alone. This is this huge void in their life. They've been companions for so many years. Share the most intimate things in their life with them. And then they're gone. They're gone. It was not good for man to be alone. And so God says, I will make a helper fit for him. The Hebrew term there is Azer Kenigno. I used to call my wife my little Azer Kenigno, and people thought I was cursing at her. But it's a term of endearment, a fitting completer, a suitable helper, an Azer Kenigno, all right? One ideally suited for, all right, is the idea. Companionship is there. So now you see that Adam and Eve was intended to be genuine partners in marriage. And this is illustrated in verses 19 through 23. So let's pick up there. Look at verse 19. Now out of the ground, the Lord God had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the livestock, to the birds of the heaven, to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found an Azer Kenigno for him. There was no... So sandwiched in between these two statements about the Azer Kenigno, fitting helper, is man naming all the animals on the planet. Say, what does that have to do with anything? Think about this just for a moment. Adam is super intelligent. How do we know that? Because Adam, in one 24-hour day, was able to name all the animals on the planet. There's a lot of animals that have gone extinct. We don't even know what they were. We're still discovering some of the bones of some of those animals, trying to find names for them. And we have records and computers to be help us, little prompts. Adam didn't have anything like that. No recording device, nothing to write things down. He was able to remember every single name that he gave to every single animal on the planet. Adam was super, super intelligent. Unbelievable. Never having to repeat any of the names at all. And if he named the animals, based upon the typical way in which a Semitic mind would work, which in fact just the ancient mind would work this way, he probably named the animals on the basis of their most common characteristic. So Mr. and Mrs. Elephant goes by, large gray creature with long nose. Most common characteristics. Mr. and Mrs. Skunk goes by, black and white creature that stinks a lot. Mr. and Mrs. Ostrich goes by, tall creatures that run really fast. Whatever their most common characteristic that kind of signified them, he named them based upon those most common characteristics. So Mr. and Mrs. Elephant, Mr. and Mrs. Skunk, Mr. and Mrs. Gerbil, Mr. and Mrs. Ostrich, Mr. and Mrs. Giraffe, Mr. and Mrs. Buffalo. and he's able to name them all. He names all of them in one 24-hour period. This was a massive, massive task. So what happens at the end of that day? At the end of the day, the whole earth is full of living creatures, full of living creatures that God had created. And yet, not only did God say that Adam was alone, Adam felt it. But, God, I can see Adam raising his hand. Lord, elephants had male and female. Skunks had male and female. Ostriches had male and female. Gerbils had male and female. Why don't I? I mean, there's no one that corresponds to me. Nothing. So, but for Adam, there was not found a suitable helper for him. Look at verse 21. Fasten your seatbelts, put your crash helmets on. You ready? So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon a man. Stop there. Deep sleep to fall upon a man, which shows you that there was pain prior to the fall. It's just now that pain is multiplied after the fall. Otherwise, there would be no need for Adam, for God to put Adam into this anesthetic state. Deep sleep fall upon a man, and while he slept, he took one of the ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that he had taken out from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. He presents Eve to Adam. Notice what Adam does. Look at this. Then Adam says, "This is at last bone of bones and flesh of flesh." Now, why does he say that? There's one other time that that specific Hebrew phrase is used in the Bible. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 1. Where the people of Israel are coronating David to be their future king. And they say to David the same words, bone of bones, flesh of flesh. What were they doing? They were vowing their loyalty to David as their future king. Bone of bones, flesh of flesh. Vowing their loyalty to David. This is exactly what Adam's doing to Eve. He sees Eve, and when he sees her, the first thing he says is bone of bones, flesh of flesh. He vows his loyalty to her, which is really remarkable. Why? Because Eve had no competition. There are no other women around. All right? Yet, he still does this. He still vows his loyalty to her. Bone of bones, flesh of flesh. I vow, this is the first marital vows. And then, what does he do? He names her. He names her. She shall be called woman. Isha is the Hebrew term. The root idea behind Isha is her most common characteristic. What is the most common characteristic? Soft. That's what it was. That's what Isha means. Soft. She shall be called softy. All right? I don't know whether he went up and poked her. I don't know. But compared to him, she was soft, and he liked that. Guys like soft. All right? He liked the fact that was her most common characteristic. He names her on the basis of her most common characteristic. She shall be called soft because she was taken on a man. So he vows his loyalty to her. Then he names her with her most common characteristic, at least that which he perceived. Now you understand, he's been around animals all day. Okay? So, compared to them, she looked soft. Probably felt soft as well. So, you understand at this particular point then, God now has created an Azer Kenigno for him. That's literally what the Hebrew word, when you read the Hebrew, you read it backwards. That's Azer and then Kenigno. All right? A suitable helper, a fitting completer, ideally suited for him, an ideal complement for him. So the animals wouldn't do to fill his loneliness. God didn't create a father for Adam, a mother for Adam, a child for Adam, a sister for Adam, a brother for Adam, a playmate for Adam. He didn't create a golfing buddy for Adam. He didn't create a hunting buddy for Adam. He didn't create a fishing buddy for Adam. He created a wife for Adam, because that's exactly what Adam needed. That's critical. She becomes now a critical part of his very life. The two become one. He creates a wife because she now is the perfect complement to address the issue of loneliness. Now, in the future, I'm going to suggest to you, again, Pastor Matt, you're going to have to deal with this someday. All right? When people start marrying robots and want to come to the church and marry their robot. All right? When that happens, that's just going to magnify the loneliness in this, in the culture and society. That's all it's going to do. It's just going to because robots are never going to replace a human being. It's never going to happen. All right? They may sound like, touch like, feel like, respond like, but it's never going to replace a human being. It'll never happen. They'll still develop, they'll try to develop it and develop it and develop it. It's not going to happen. The loneliness is just going to multiply. So, what does that mean now? So now marriage becomes covenantal bond. Notice this in verse 24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall be one flesh, and the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. So marriage becomes a covenant. In fact, it's referred to that way in Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 17, Malachi chapter 2 verse 14 in the Bible. So God recognized it to be a covenant. This is the Hebrew word berit, not burrito, that's Mexican. Berit, all right? Berit, that's a covenant. It means to cut a covenant, okay? It means to cut a covenant. Back in ancient times, that's exactly what would happen. When two people made an agreement together, they didn't sign papers the way we do today. Instead, they would take an animal and slaughter an animal and cut the animal exactly in half and lay one half of the animal on one side, the other half on the other side, and the two parties would walk between the two halves of the animal in public view so that everybody knew those two parties were making this covenant together. Basically, that covenant said, in slaughtering that animal, may God do to us what was done to this animal if we were ever to break this covenant. So covenant now becomes a very sacred bond. Slaying the animal, shedding of blood, walking between the two halves of the animal. May God do to us what has been done to this animal if we were ever to sever this relationship. If we were to ever break this relationship. So now marriage was considered a sacred, unbreakable bond, a lasting lifetime commitment. That's a berit. That's a covenant. Marriage now is a sacred covenant made before God and in public, saying that for a lifetime unto death, we are married. Unto death we are married. That's what God intended marriage to be. And then he described it in verse 24, Genesis 2:24, in this way. The essential unity of marriage now is three parts. One is there is this leaving of father and mother. Now this is really key here. Why? Because the parent-child relationship God intended from the very beginning to be a temporary relationship. That is somewhat shocking to the contemporary American Christian family today, because oftentimes we treat our children as if they're going to be with us forever. And the children become the center of the home. Child-centered Christian homes are everywhere. I remember several years ago, we had a pastor's fellowship in Ohio where I pastored for 25 years. And it was called Grace Partners. My wife and I would go to it once a month. Pastors and wives would get together from several different churches. One day we were sitting around and we were having fellowship together. We usually have lunch together and then we talk about various things that were going on in our churches. And then we discovered that in several of the churches, people that had been married 25, 30 years were all of a sudden announcing to people they were getting a divorce. And as pastors, we were scratching our heads, what in the world is going on here? And one of the things that we discovered in every single case in every one of those churches where that was happening, the parents had homeschooled their kids. Now, I was not opposed to homeschooling. My wife's not opposed. We homeschooled our kids for several years. So don't look at me like I'm a homeschool hater. I'm not. All right? Not a homeschool hater. But what had happened is, and this can happen, when you do something like that, it's very, very easy for the children to become the center of the home. I mean, mom and dad focus all their attention around the kids. Everything goes around the kids. Everything happens. And over the years, this just builds and builds and builds and builds until all of a sudden, 25 years later, kids grow up. They go off, get married. And now all of a sudden, mom and dad look at each other and say, well, thanks a lot. And they shake hands and they go their different ways. There's no investment in their marriage or in their relationship. We were determined that not to have that happen. We had four kids. First two were daughters. Second two were twins, twin boys. Twin boys just turned 30. I feel really old when that happens. Twin boys just turned 30. But when those boys were little babies, so much concentration went into working with those little kids and stuff. One weekend, my wife remembers this really well because it was strategic in her thinking. I said, we're going to get away from the kids. We're just going to get away and make an investment in everything. Oh, no, I can't do it. You know, I've got to stay here and do this and this and this with the babies. No, we're going to get away. Grandma. And we had both grandmas there. And we turned grandmas loose on the babies. Get away. And we looked at that time as a really critical time in our relationship. Those have to be designed. The kids are not the center of the home. The husband-wife relationship is the center of the home. And it has to be cultivated as a center home. You have to raise your kids to leave, not stay. You have to raise them to leave. That's really critical. When our kids got out of high school, went to college, and they came home from college, we started charging them rent to stay in our house. And as time went on, the rent went up, making it hard for them to stay till it was cheaper to live somewhere else. We were making money, let me tell you. All right? But until they realized, we've got to get out. We need to make it easy for them to leave. And when the last one left, I chased Janie around the house. All right? But that's the idea. The kids are to be reared to leave the home, not stay in the home. And I don't love my kids any less than you do. But you've got to raise them to leave. Your relationship as a husband and wife has got to be number one in that home. It's got to be. It is the husband and wife relationship that is the permanent relationship in that home. God intended that from the very beginning. He makes that very, very clear when he says the kids must leave. We violated that in our culture. Child-centered American homes are destroying marriages. Kids are not number one. Kids are number two in that home. The relationship of the husband and wife is number one. And anything that you're doing to make the kids think that they're number one is actually laying seeds of your marriage destruction in the future. You can't do that. Then he says, cleave. The word, actually in the Hebrew, means to weld together. To weld together. Leave, be welded together, which is the basis of the commitment. The Bible doesn't say, listen, the Bible doesn't say leave in love. The Bible doesn't say leave and enter into an intense infatuation with. The Bible doesn't say leave and enter into a deep romantic relationship with. The Bible doesn't say that anywhere. The Bible says leave and cleave. That's Hollywood, but that's not Bible. When you make the vacillating feelings of human emotions the foundation of marriage, then all of a sudden, marriage is in trouble. I mean, what happens 5 years in the marriage and in the middle of the night he rolls over and first time he gets a good look at her without makeup? Ah! What did I just marry? Or she rolls over 5 years into marriage, and there he is, sound asleep. What have I married? All of a sudden, all of those nice, intense, romantic relationships go woo out the window. Now reality sets in. I married a human being with all their frailties and difficulties, and that's the person I married. No, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say leave and enter into an intense romantic relationship with. I want to suggest to you that when the foundation of your relationship is a sacred commitment made before God, then all the right kind of love feelings grows out of that. But the foundation of the marriage is not the love feelings. The foundation of the marriage is the commitment. All the right kind of love feelings grows out of that commitment. It's not based upon those feelings. That has got to be the foundation. From the very beginning, that's the way that God intended marriage. And then thirdly, he says, become one flesh. One flesh, and that means much more than just physically become one. It means spiritually they become one. It means in parenting, they become one. They have the same view of parenting, those kids, so that when mom speaks, the kids know that dad's speaking. When dad speaks, the kids know that mom's speaking. There's, if they have any disagreement in terms of parenting, it's always out of eyesight and earsight of the kids. So the kids don't hear any of the disagreement. The only things presented to those kids is a united front all the time. That's the only time. That's the only thing that they ever see. Mom and dad speak with one voice, one flesh. They see one person. That's it. Financially, you become one. That's really critical. How is that? That means one of the best things you can do for the unity of your marriage is have a good budget. Most couples look at budgets like straitjackets. They're not. One of the things we work on in marital counseling. One of the first things is the budget. Why? Because you only have a certain amount of money that comes into your marriage. And you have to decide as a couple how you're going to spend that money. Your budget now is a reflection of your agreed upon value system. That's all it is. This just represents your value system. It's an external representation of your value system. And in marriage, by talking through a budget, you're talking about unifying your value system as a couple. Now, so that's what we do. We have a budget. I mean, when we were first married, it was a very simple budget. But it was now our budget goes on for pages and pages. All right. But when we were first married, it was a very, very simple budget. But at the end of the day, then she has her money she spends, and I have my money that I spend out of the budget. I don't have to call her when I want to buy my Sprite Zero. All right? I don't have to call her for that. But yet, in every other way, we have this agreed upon way in which we're so much is going to go to housing, so much is going to go to the car. But right off the top, by the way, of our budget, we've always done this, is what our giving is to the Lord. That's the first thing we do. Then we have to learn to live within the rest of that and pay the rest of our bills. So first thing we do is how much we're going to give to the Lord. Then the next thing we do is whatever's left over, then we have to learn to bring our value system in line to whatever's left over. So at the end of the month, you have a positive figure, not a negative figure. So you're not spending more than you have in your budget. You know when this came to me? It was a first year of marriage. She knows exactly what I'm talking about. We had a terrible winter. I mean, it was a really bad winter. The winter there in southern Ohio, we had snow, and they had National Guard tanks delivering milk to people. That's the only thing that was moving on. The snow was higher than I stood, and you just had paths that you walked through in the snow. Maybe you've seen winters around here, especially up in the mountains, you get winters like that. But we didn't usually see those there, but that was really something. And I needed a winter coat, and I happened to get away during one of the breaks in the weather and found the sale on winter coats, and it was exactly what I needed, and I had $50, a $100 coat for half price. I bought that thing, brought it home. I said, sweetie, look at this. She was in the back room working in an apartment. Came back out. I said, I got a new coat, half price. She said, how much you pay for that? $50. Was that $50 you had in your wallet? Yeah. Well, okay. She turned around and walked away. I said, whoops, no, wait a minute. She's not as excited as I am about this. All right, something just happened here. And then come to figure out that $50 in her wallet, she had plans for that. She wanted, you know, they weren't that important, pay the rent with it and groceries. And when I was a single guy, I'd just skip a few meals if I wanted to do that and buy whatever I wanted. But I'm married, I can't do that anymore. All right? Because I had to begin to realize this is not mine anymore. This is ours. This is not mine, it's ours. That's the oneness. When you think it's yours, you lack the oneness. That's the critical thing. Now I begin to look at that and say, wait a minute, that's not mine. That's ours. I can't just do anything that I want with it. When I was a single guy, I could do that. I don't do that anymore. I'm married. That makes everything different. So three things. Leaving. That means parent-child relationship is temporary. Leaving means you're welded together. The basis of your relationship is that of commitment. It's not the vacillating feelings of human love, romance, or emotion. Becoming one flesh, unifying yourself together as one, and you think and view life as one. That's critical. All of those things are key to being one flesh. Now, after our break, we're going to talk about God's design for husbands. And ladies, you'll need to get an extra pen with lots of ink. And we'll talk about God's intended role.